This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the part of the program which we always call the big picture, where rather than present endless data points, we actually try to give you some perspective so you understand what is happening out there. And in the light of this, if you have been a listener to the show, you know that we cover several topics. Quite often we talk about the LEIs, the leading economic indicators, and their relationship to the economy. Then we also talk about the Federal Reserve, because ultimately it determines what happens in the financial markets and how you should invest. We also try to alert you to trend changes that are coming up so you can make plans. And today we're going to throw in another topic on that called risk management. How to do it. That would be the first thing. Number two, why you should do it. And then how to master your own worst investment nightmare, which is, guess what? You and your emotions, either fear or greed. Both of those can kill you in the investment process. So we're going to talk about all of that risk management today.
Well, you know, if you've been listening to this program, you know, technicians that we have here, and we try to get a wide variety of them to give you a sort of different views, because every technician has their own views on the market or different approaches. But the one thing they all have in common, they talk about three trends in the market: the primary trend, the intermediary trend, and the short-term trend. And as technicians, they look at short-term trends. That would be a one-year chart or shorter. Intermediary trends would be weekly charts, and primary trends are monthly. Well, if you look at what the market is saying and what the technicians on the program have been saying here, if you look at the primary trend, well, just as Art Hill talked about in hour one, it is up. If you look at the intermediary trend, that is also up. If there's anything that's down, it's probably the short-term trend, with the Dow having its worst week of the year this week, with fears over what's going on in North Korea. Now, right now, as Art Hill has talked about in hour one, the primary trend of the markets is up. And it's not just up for stocks. It's up for several asset categories. The primary trend in stocks is up since the beginning of the year. Likewise, the primary trend with bonds is also up, and especially doing well this week. We'll talk about that later on. And the primary trend of gold has also been up in this year. The problem is, when markets are in strong uptrends, as they are now, well, guess what? We tend to forget about risk, and we become complacent. If everything's doing well, the question is, why should you worry? And that's what people tend to do. They think, well, everything's great. The economy's doing well. Unemployment is low. The stock market is setting new records week after week. There's nothing really serious going on other than, basically, we'll get into this today, of events in North Korea. But this is also primarily the time you want to think about risk. If you go back, think of the year 2000, or let's say the end of 99. Was anybody thinking about risk with valuations? I mean, stock markets were at records. People were making double-digit returns like they have in the markets this year. Likewise, in 2007, stocks were going up. The S&P had reached a level close to where it reached in March of 2000. Stock or real estate prices were also going up double digits. So what the heck? Why worry? Well, one thing we know, recessions and bear markets begin by a Fed rate raising cycle, and which is where we are today. And what makes this cycle different than anything that we have seen before is the Fed is beginning this rate raising cycle from a point where interest rates were at zero. If you think back to the year 2004, when Greenspan began to raise interest rates, the Fed funds rate was 1%. Well, it's taken the Fed nearly 4 years from announcing it was getting rid of taper to starting raising interest rates. It's taken it 4 years to get interest rates to 1%. We are now getting closer to 1.5%. So what makes this cycle different? Well, we've never seen this before. And that's why you've heard several of the guests I've had here on the program talking about the old Edson Gould adage about three steps and a stumble, which referred to any time the Fed had raised interest rates three times, get ready to tumble. Usually that there was problems in the stock market. But unlike the past, This rule applied when the federal funds rate, when normally they would lower rates in the past, the Fed funds rate was at 5, 6, 7%. They'd lower it down to 3. So when we started interest rates, or the Fed started to raise rates, they started at a Fed funds rate of 3%. This time, we started with the Fed funds rate, not at 1%, but at 0.
And we do know from experience, Jim, that they raise rates until something goes kerplooey, till they crash the airplane. They've been doing this since, World War II, something like that. And so why would this time be any different if that's the trend that's been set? And what really comes to mind about this is that the markets are still going up on the Trump, what do we call it? The Trump euphoria, possibly in the area of tax cuts, infrastructure repair, or the repeal of Obamacare. However, those things are tending to roll off quite a bit now. So how long that will last remains to be seen.
Well, I mean, if there's one thing, we are now in the ninth year of this business recovery, and we know that the Fed is going to accelerate the things that they're doing. The market expects another rate hike by the end of the year, and then as we head into the fall, it's expecting that the Fed will begin to start shrinking its balance sheet, and like anything else, that shrinkage will begin to accelerate every single quarter as they fail to roll over more and more money, which is another way of saying liquidity is going to be taken out of the market. Now, what could change that? The biggest thing that can change that is tax cuts, but here's one of the problems. If, let's say they get a tax cut through, I think they are. I don't think it's going to be as big as the president promised or what everybody's hoping. You just can't. There's just way too much debt out there today, especially government debt. But here's what happens. If you get those tax cuts coming in at the corporate level, individual level, what will that do? It'll extend the business cycle. Number two, it's more likely to increase the rate of inflation, which will lead to step three, which means the Fed will get more aggressive. You might see, as the Fed did at the end of 2016, they said, you know what, we're changing our mind about 2017. Instead of 2 rate cuts, we're going to do 3. Right now, the markets are pricing in several rate cuts for 2018. What if we do get tax cuts? The economy starts to heat up, inflation heats up. That's why I watch the price of oil, because that's one that's going to catch a lot of people by surprise, I believe. And all of a sudden, the Fed says, you know what? Next year, we're going to raise rates 4 times. Or the Fed accelerates its shrinking of its balance sheet. Remember, within 3 quarters, whenever they begin, they will be withdrawing $30 billion a month from the marketplace, which means there's going to be less buyers in the marketplace. The European Central Bank is going to start their version of taper, which means they will be buying less in the marketplace. So you have the two biggest central banks in the world will be withdrawing liquidity from the marketplace. We know sooner or later that's going to lead to trouble. Number two, if there are no tax cuts, the business cycle will be short-lived. In other words, we're in the ninth inning right now, the ninth year, and especially if we get no tax cuts and the Fed continues to tighten. And the thing you have to understand, Yellen is clueless of the risk, is a lot of the models that the Fed uses are flawed. It's one of the reasons why their forecasts are off almost 95% of the time. And the reason is most of these guys are academics. None of them have ever worked in the real economy, or for that matter, ever worked on a trading desk on Wall Street. So two things are going to happen, John. Either one, nothing will happen. They won't get a tax cut, which will shortchange, and we'll get closer to the end of this business cycle, especially if the Fed continues to tighten with shrinking its balance sheet and raising interest rates. As we know, they'll eventually crash the plane. Secondly, it could get extended into 2018, maybe towards the end of the year, maybe even 2019, depending on what develops with tax cuts and what the Fed does. But if there are no tax cuts, we know that this business cycle will be shortened. So those are the things that we know right now that are in process. And that's why one of the reasons why we know every recession, every bear market has been preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle. What do you know right now? You know the Fed, and we are in a Fed rate raising cycle, and the Fed keeps telling us we're still going to do this. We still plan on raising interest rates. And in addition to that, we are now going to do something we've never done. We're going to shrink the balance sheet. And quite honestly, they've never done that before. So who knows what will happen if they begin to accelerate that, as that liquidity is withdrawn from the market at the same time the ECB proceeds down the same road.
You know, the one thing that both parties seem to agree to is the whole subject of infrastructure. And if we got the infrastructure projects going, which we need to do, there are places in the, say, for example, the highway system where a lot of things need to be replaced. You would think that would stimulate the economy towards jobs. So that's one area you could put something where we might get some activity.
The only problem is, John, and we saw this with the Obama administration, we saw it likewise with the Bush administration. Bush came in with the infrastructure spending, rebuilding the military. That took time to take place. He put in a small tax cut, which did nothing. We were still in a recession, so they had to come back with a second tax cut and really cut rates to stimulate the economy. The problem with infrastructure spending, by the time it works through the committee, by the time it gets passed, by the time the president signs it into law, by the time it works its way through the bureaucracy, from the bureaucracy to the state bureaucracy at the state level, because that's where the infrastructure spending is going to take place, and by the time you have to go through all the environmental red tape, this could be 2 to 3 years before it does any good. So as you look at the economy and the markets, you know, a lot of this is going to take time. The only thing they really could do if they really want to stimulate the economy would be tax cuts, because you talk infrastructure, yes, they could agree on something like that. You know, both parties love to spend money, and congressmen love to bring home the bacon to their district and say, you know, to their voters, say, look, you hired me and look what I did. Look at the jobs I brought back home. But unfortunately, that takes time.
Well, as we've discussed here on the program before, we were talking about it last week, a lot of people, even people we have on the program who are experts in various areas, still believe we have a way to go before this whole thing rolls over. And to use a phrase, you're still dancing in this hole.
Yeah, but you know, eventually this leads to a major financial crisis, and you think of 2007 and 2008. Now, looking back at the last financial crisis, which seems to be distant memory now, that was 9 years ago, actually 10 years ago when it started in 2007, the question always comes up of money itself. And that was one of the big issues that came up in the last financial crisis. It began in 2007, 10 years ago, actually this week, when a French bank suspended payments on two money market funds. And that was right around this time, John, in the year 2007. Nobody was thinking of a financial crisis. You had Chuck Prince at that time saying, you know, as long as the music's playing, we got to keep dancing. You had Ben Bernanke, when interviewed about real estate, he says, real estate is doing fine, nothing to worry about, it never goes down. Well, we know we were heading into a recession, and that, those were the first signs of a financial crisis. And savers began to learn what they thought was cash was really credit, because when you're in a money market fund, the instruments that that money market fund invests in, whether it's commercial paper, bank CDs, or typically, or even government short-term treasury bills, you're really looking at credit instruments, and that eventually the financial banking system was at risk, which was what happened with money market funds. They began to break the buck. The Fed had to come in and backstop money market funds. The next thing that unfolded is the commercial paper markets froze, and that's very important to short-term financing for corporations. I remember during the freezing up of the commercial markets, where it basically shut down, it froze. I remember one of our listeners was a produce broker, and he used the commercial paper market. He would go into the commercial paper market, borrow money for 3 months. He would go to Farmer John, buy lettuce or whatever he was buying from the farmers, ship it off to the grocery stores, and he would get paid about 90 days later in the payment cycle. So he would always use the commercial paper market to finance his business. And I remember him saying, and sending me an email, he says, man, if this thing doesn't open up, you're going to start seeing food disappear off the grocery shelves. So eventually it began in money markets, hit the commercial paper market, and then it spread to the banking system after Lehman, as one financial institution from Lehman to Merrill to AIG went under and had to be rescued by Congress with that infamous $700 billion bailout.
So from that perspective, then, what do things look like today?
None of that risk is apparent today outside maybe the derivative markets. Banks are in fairly good shape. They just went through several stress tests that the Fed put them through. But here's the thing. Consumers are still leveraged. The only reason consumers look good today on their debt is the assets they own. Their homes are back up. They're not under like they were back in, let's say, 2009, 10, 11, and 12 before the real estate market started to take off. Corporations have leveraged up their balance sheet in terms of buying back stock, raising dividends. Governments are also leveraged. I mean, the U.S. government now has $20 trillion in debt, something that didn't exist when this century began when they only had $5 trillion. But the perceptions of the market are highly skewed right now, and that is dangerous.
If you were to look at those perceptions and then try to define them in some way, what would that be?
I would say probably the common perceptions held by everybody, and especially even the central bank, there's a universal belief in the markets right now that inflation will remain low for an extended period of time. After all, the Fed has yet to achieve its inflation goals of 2%. Or recently, with the drop in oil prices when it got back into 40, inflation began to recede. The second perception out there is central banks will be slow and cautious about tightening monetary policy. That is probably correct if assumption number one, inflation remains low. If inflation starts to increase, oil prices start to rise, watch for central banks to begin to change their language. Number three, the other assumption is with corporate bond spreads very narrow right now, corporate debt costs will remain low. And a lot of corporations are in the market borrowing in commercial paper, and they're also in short-term corporate debt instruments, which are very low. It's what a lot of people do when they finance a mortgage. There are a lot of people I know that have variable rate mortgages and are paying interest rates at 3% or low rather than a fixed rate mortgage of 4%. And number four, profit margins will stay high forever. And what do we know? The labor market is tightening. Wages are growing. They're not out of line yet. And we're not seeing a high acceleration in wages. But those are four key assumptions that are out there. And the implications are twofold. One, two issues that we talked about. If they are right, all these assumptions are right, then returns on investments will remain low in the future. Secondly, if these assumptions prove to be incorrect, then you could see short-term losses and they could be very big, which always happens. When the markets are going along with the trend and they extrapolate that trend to exist for an extended period of time, then all of a sudden something changes. A good example would be what happened to oil when it was at over $100 a barrel, and then OPEC in November 2014 and says, nope, we're not going to cut back. We're going to actually start pumping more oil. And then all of a sudden, the price of oil dropped precipitously to $60 a barrel, and everybody thought that was good for the economy until it dropped down to $20 a barrel. We lost over 100,000 high-paying jobs, and all of a sudden, that whole perception began to change. But right now, investors have been lulled into complacency to an extraordinary degree, and that's been reflected recently as we've seen in the VIX, which spiked this week from about a little 9.5 and got all the way up to almost 18, down a little bit here on Friday with the markets turning positive.
So basically what you're saying, and Art Hill is saying it too, is that the markets are pricing no major moves in bonds or gold, but these moves are tending to be what? The risk-off trade? Is that what we're seeing here?
Yeah, you saw a drop in bond yields this week, and you saw a spike in gold as we had the sell-off on stocks, and we had the back-and-forth spat between North Korea's leader and our own president. But right now, if there was trouble, we would probably begin to see it. If there was serious trouble, we'd begin to see it in the bond market. Right now, bond spreads have narrowed considerably. The spread between top-rated junk bonds, those are bonds rated double B, and treasuries, is only 2.2%. That is a very, very narrow spread. And normally, when you start to see serious trouble, it first begins to surface in the bond markets. The second thing we know right now is market valuations are stretched and priced for perfection. So the market valuations are also stretched and they're priced for perfection. So right now, the bond market is signaling no trouble. Stock prices are overvalued, but that doesn't mean they still can't go higher.
Yeah, I guess the real question is then what can go wrong with this Goldilocks scenario?
Going back to the perceptions that are being widely held by market and investors right now, inflation will remain low, central banks will be cautious in their tightening, and corporate profit margins will stay elevated. The good news is when the economy is growing and you're not in a recession, the markets and the economy are better able to handle and weather a short-term disruption or a shock. If I use a weather analogy, the shocks turn out to be something like a short-term squall, what comes out of nowhere for 15 minutes and then it's over. And more than anything else, if you're in an uptrend, it presents a buying opportunity. Trouble erupts, however, when central banks crash the plane and they become too aggressive. In hindsight, they never know when they've gone too far until afterwards. So that is really the big question here, because right now, what do we know? Our central bank is proceeding. They are getting a little more aggressive. In addition to raising rates, they are now going to start taking money out of the market by shrinking their balance sheet. We know the ECB is now getting ready to taper and cut back on its bond buying. So two large players in the bond market are backing out and taking away some of the punch bowl. And so, like I said, if you want to know where trouble is, the first place to sniff it will be the bond market.
Yeah, we're talking about risk management here. So how do you then, given where we are here, hedge against risk, especially trying to anticipate where some of the unknowns might spring out at us?
Well, I mean, you start with what we know right now. What do we know? Well, let's start with the basics. The most important thing to focus on is we are now in a Fed rate raising cycle, albeit a different one historically, because we're beginning with low interest rates. But eventually, what we do know from history is they will crash the airplane. That's why last week we said we're still dancing, but we're gradually moving closer to the exit door. And as I have said, we are not 100% invested in stocks right now as we were, let's say, going back in 2012 and 2013 or 2014. We're only 70 to 80% invested in stocks, and that depends on a person's objective. So one of the things you want to do when you want to hedge, because you don't know when something's going to come up. I mean, did anybody really expect what we were seeing with North Korea? You know, they've been sort of shooting off missiles, but they've been doing that with every president going back to Bill Clinton. So the one thing you don't want to do is be 100% invested in any asset class, as many investors are doing today, especially now that we are finally seeing the public, which has been absent this bull market for the first 9 years, they are finally coming in. They're going into index funds and index ETFs. We talked last week, major brokerage firms like Schwab, TD, all of them are reporting that they are opening up record amounts of stock market accounts. In fact, as we mentioned last week, Schwab is reporting the greatest amount of stock accounts open since the year 2000, the peak of the internet bubble. And speaking of bubbles, as we have mentioned here for, gosh, the last 3 months, we are now seeing the formation of a bubble, in my opinion, which is being formed in these index funds and ETFs and mutual funds. And this is a question I asked recently when I interviewed Ned Davis.
By the late 1990s, some of the people that were in value investors said they didn't understand the market anymore and they were just going to get out, because the crave then was with growth stock investing. Well, what's wrong with buying stocks that are growing faster than the economy? Well, obviously, nothing's wrong with the theory itself, but when it gets too popular and everybody wants to do it, then you get a crowded trade. And if something goes wrong, then it becomes a bubble that bursts. And so there's really the idea of passive investing. In other words, if you have a lot of active investors and they're all competing with each other, then on average, they're going to have average performance. So why pay extra fees when you can just buy the averages and get the same performance without the fees? So it's really a solid idea that the Vanguard funds really and John Bogle came up with, and I think it's a great idea, but it's just gotten more and more popular to where now it's just everybody wants to be a passive investor. And the problem with passive investing is you buy all 500 stocks, let's say, in the S&P 500 without regard to whether they're doing well or whether they're low quality, high quality, whether they have good values or poor values. And you can push the stocks that have poor values up to higher and higher heights and really make for an unstable situation.
That was from an interview Jim did recently with Ned Davis. We're going to air that during our August recess. So now, outside of not being 100% invested in stocks, what else do you do to hedge against risk?
I mean, one of the common things, everybody knows the importance of diversification, but you should have some percentage of bonds, because a good example is with the downturn in markets this week, what has done well this week? Bonds have rallied, gold has rallied. So anytime you get a stock market correction, bonds do well. And, you know, it's one of the things we're doing. We're in bonds, we're in interest rate floaters and specialty funds that do well under these circumstances. So those kind of investments are a hedge against a stock market downturn. Another hedge you might want to consider is have some cash reserves. You heard Art Hill in Hour 1 talking about, well, you might want to keep a little powder dry as we go through this corrective process here. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about contrary thinking, the second part of the big picture today, to keep some of that dry. So it's a good choice to use, but I would recommend you only use a Treasury money market fund, because as investors found out in 2007 and 2009, is those money market funds can break the buck. And now it's official. As a change of the laws of 2016, in a market downturn, if there's a big withdrawal in money market funds, you may not get back a buck. So if you put in $100, you may only get $95 back, or $96. So cash such as money market funds or maybe even CDs. The other choices for risk off is to have a small portion in gold. Gold has done very well this week. With political tensions, we're approaching close to 1,300, and several of the technicians believe that gold is in an uptrend. As Art pointed out, since the beginning of the year, one asset class has done well, along with stocks, has been gold as well as bonds. But outside of that, the other thing you could do is use either puts or use things like inverse ETF funds. In other words, they go in the opposite direction. But it is a very, very dangerous approach to use when the stock market's primary trend is an uptrend. So that's a quick way to lose a lot of money. So I don't recommend that as a hedging vehicle at this point, especially when you're in a primary uptrend in the market. A more effective way to hedge would be the use of options, but that takes less money. But you really need to know what you're doing, when to buy, and how to buy them, whether you're buying short-term or leaps. And also, this is a strategy that I would recommend you only use when you have the telltale signs that we are indeed heading into a recession and a bear market. But if you were to try to use inverse, let's say, mutual funds, I mean, what if you yesterday bought an inverse ETF because you're thinking the market's in a downturn? Look at today where the market is up. So that's why it's important to know where you are and what phase of the market. Are you in a primary uptrend? What's the intermediate trend? And what's the short-term trend? And when that primary trend is up, as you are in a bull market, it is a very high-risk scenario to try to hedge with either puts or inverse funds, and I don't recommend it. It's a quick way to lose a lot of money. The other thing, too, is if you are going to go in this direction because you know that the Fed is eventually going to crash the airplane, you better be very liquid and have a lot of staying power. The hedge funds that made billions, if not fortunes, during the financial downturn between 2007 and 2009, they started accumulating those positions, many of them in 2006, which means that as they accumulated those positions, the market continued to go up until October of 2007. So they were losing money in those positions. So you have to have the liquidity, because you're leveraged, to ride out that short term until that primary trend flips and goes in the opposite direction. So you better be well capitalized if you're going to do that. And I don't recommend you do it for novice investors, or if you're not familiar with how to manage dynamic risk on that basis. What we do recommend right now is you shouldn't be 100% invested in the stock market, unless you have maybe you're 25, 30, you're dollar cost averaging in a 401k, and you're just saying, you know what, I got 40 years till I retire. If we go through a recession, a bear market in a year from now, well, what the heck? I'll be buying stocks at a cheaper price. But if you are 10 years away from retirement, 5 years away from retirement, just started retirement, you're taking a lot of risk if you're now jumping into the stock market after being out for nearly 8 or 9 years. So if you look at all the things that you can do, cash, short-term bonds, have a little gold, but don't be 100% invested in one asset class. And the problem is, John, that's what people tend to do. They get excited about something like real estate in the last decade, tech stocks in the 90s, or let's say gold in 2010 and 11, or more recently this year, stocks for the first time, and especially since the beginning of the summer.
Okay, well, I know you're not 100% in stocks, maybe somewhere between, 70 or 80%, depending on objectives. But now, what would get you to lower that percentage based on factors involving risk management?
Well, I mean, the things that we do is we watch our LEIs. And when they begin to roll over in turn, we have a recession indicator when it gets to 20. We also have technical indicators. When all three of those are confirming each other and rolling over and they begin to worsen, we will move accordingly to protect our clients' assets as individuals should do. And this is, by the way, the topic of our upcoming wealth preservation seminar coming up October 21st. It's going to be an all-day event. We're going to talk about what happens in this final stage. We're going to talk about risk management. We're going to talk about things to look for, telltale signs, and that's going to be coming up on October 21st. It'll be an all-day event. It's for clients, and there is a $100 charge for non-clients to attend. It'll be going all day, so we'll be serving breakfast and lunch. It's mainly the cost is to cover the meals, but we are going to be addressing these issues and taking a look at where we are as we head into this fall and what I believe will be the final inning. And remember, the final innings sometimes can take 2 years to play out. Just as Alan Greenspan said in 1996, Irrational Exuberance, well, things really didn't get crazy until 1998 and went on for 2 years before the whole thing came tumbling down. But when it did, you know, the NASDAQ lost 70%. In 2007 to 2009, the S&P lost 60%. And if you really think about it, from the year 2000 until April 2013, the S&P on a price basis went zero places or 0% for 13 years.
So if we summarize this up, I think what you're recommending here is people need to start thinking in terms of risk management. We are in a Fed rate raising cycle. You should not be 100% in the stock market unless you're young and dollar cost averaging and say you maybe have another 40 years to go before retirement. But you also need to start thinking now how you're going to manage risk, because all Goldilocks, what do we call them, experiences do come to an end, and you have to be ready for that.
I'm Jim Poplava. With the stock market at record levels and the Fed raising interest rates, join me and my staff of experts at my upcoming Wealth Preservation Seminar, which will be held in San Diego on October 21st. We're going to cover the economy, the possibility of a recession and bear market, and what signs to look for that this economic market cycle is coming to an end. More importantly, strategies you can use to protect yourself and your family. Make your reservations today, as there will be limited seating for this special event. Call 888-486-3939 to make your reservations today. Once again, that is 888-486-3939. Call now.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
It does seem that there is a bit of a flight from states like California that have very high cost of living, that have incredibly high housing costs, that have ridiculously high tax rates, in either adjacent states or places like Texas. Toyota just moved their national headquarters, for example, from Southern California to North Dallas and took with it hundreds of good-paying jobs. And when that type of organization uproots, it's not just the jobs affected for that company itself. It's a lot of the local service firms and restaurants and contractors that support those organizations that suddenly find themselves scurrying around trying to find new business.
Malcolm, our job tonight actually is to scare people to death on this subject so the talk isn't as free as it is about a preemptive or surgical military strike. You know that part of the world. The population centers, Andrea and the general have talked about South Korea, the Japanese, and so on and so on.
That was the very familiar voice of Brian Williams from MSNBC. Welcome back to Financial Sense News Hour and The Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Lefter here with you. Media are becoming a problem, not just in the mind of some of their viewers, but in the minds of some of the professionals. As our guests such as Todd Mariano talked about the market sell-off this week, they're portraying North Korea as the equivalent of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, Jim, you and I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it really was a crisis. I mean, we were having a showdown in the Caribbean between Nikita Khrushchev and President John Kennedy. And it was whether or not the president was going to be able to turn the Russian ships around that were bringing missiles to place on the island of Cuba, which they knew they were doing. And I remember that because I was in high school. We were on the edge of our seats. We were really wondering if World War III wasn't at our doors. And finally, Premier Khrushchev blinked and they turned the ships around. When we look at North Korea, right now it's a lot of rhetoric. The capability of whether or not they could actually defend themselves remains to be seen. There are a lot of experts talking about this right now. But if you look at it, North Korea is more afraid of Chinese troops on its border than it is of the United States, which is why China's involved as well in terms of this whole thing and China's efforts to project power in the South China Sea. The problem here that we have now is that news has become instantaneous. It's worldwide. Literally, when something happens within a short block of time, you can go to newspapers in different languages around the world and the story is already there. So the first problem, and ironically, you wonder why you say it's a problem, is because everybody's knee-jerking and reacting to the first indications of a story. That's the first thing. The second thing is, as a result of that, news networks have become much more sensational in order to capture viewers' attention. They have really moved away from journalism, and I don't care whether it's CNN or Fox News, they have moved away from the idea of journalism, and they have managed to turn a 15-minute newscast into a 24-hour event. And there is much more that's important that they can cover out there, but they don't. I mean, you and I know, Jim, from our own research that the stories that could potentially be covered are much more important. The second thing is a lot of times when they do start covering things rapidly, they don't have a lot of perspective. They're flopping around. And I've been in on some of their productions because I handled remote setups for a client. And, you know, they start flopping around trying to find an, quote, expert, end quote, who can throw some light on what's going on as everybody's scrambling to say, what does this really mean? Views have become more magnified, okay? People sound a little more magnified. The voices are a little more shrill, and people are tending to get much more excited. Quite often, if you get into debates with your friend, you don't wind up debating facts. You just wind up throwing links back and forth about different stories. And that brings me down to my next comment, is the age of fake news is upon us in that many of the news outlets are more concerned about projecting their narratives and ignoring stories and facts which contradict those narratives rather than reporting the news. On my own show, I had an opportunity. We'll have him on by the 26th on my show, Steel on Steel. I interviewed a Pulitzer Prize winner, Michael Goodwin. He wrote a very important article, Media Meltdown in the Trump Era. And he was talking about his days at the New York Times when Abe Rosenthal, who was the editor, who's now deceased, made very clear efforts to make the newspaper of record. It's now becoming the newspaper of wreckage because he knew that journalists would drag it to the left. He said journalists tend to be on the left. His job was to drag it back to the right so that the paper would go straight. And indeed, on Rosenthal's tombstone is the expression, he kept the paper straight, you know, meaning neither to the left nor to the right, but it was actual real news reporting. It's gone way off those rails. And what Michael Goodwin is saying now is, can the media ever regain their credibility? And this actually affects how people are investing. I remember during the crash, Jim, people were making stupid decisions based on the hype that came out of the media.
You know, that's interesting. A number of years ago, I interviewed a former editor at the New York Times, William McGowan. He wrote a book called Gray Lady Down, What the Decline and Fall of the New York Times Means for America. And this was published November 16th, 2010. He was actually on the show. Gosh, I wish we had the archives. We could have played a couple things. The problem that we have, and this is a clip I want to go to, a angel investor out of Silicon Valley basically said, it's not just organizations like the Times, Fox News, it's also social media with Facebook or Google. Everything has to get amplified because you're trying to compete against so many things that you're competing for individual attention. Let's go to that clip of Roger McNamee on CNBC.
For all intents and purposes, this battle for attention has essentially caused everybody to have this insight that if you're trying to maintain attention, if you're fighting for a share of 24 hours in people's lives, the big issue is you have to keep escalating. And the way it turns out, the way science, they've figured this out, the way you keep people's attention is you either scare them or you make them angry.
Gosh, so true. Whether it's been shootings or it's events like we're seeing right now with North Korea. So that's why in this segment, we're going to talk about the art of contrary view. You've got to look at things different because the media, as you talk about, John, I think that's probably one thing of the modern internet age, and especially with our smartphones and social media, is an event that used to take maybe 15 minutes is now turned into 24-hour news, if not days of the same thing. If there's an awful terrorist attack or some unspeakable event happens tonight, we're going to talk to the high school friend of Mr. So-and-so. I mean, it just, they take it to the extremes. And I remember, John, you and I were reporting on this. Remember when the hurricanes hit in 2005 with Katrina and Rita? I can remember Greta Van Susteren. She was out on the beach. I mean, the winds were blowing 60, 70 knots. You could see stuff blown in the air. I mean, I thought literally they were going to strap the reporters to the tree to get everybody's attention. And I remember the next night they were showing this building where Greta had been the night before when the hurricane was coming through. It got completely demolished, and Greta Van Susteren was there just the night before. But I mean, that's what you have to do. And that's why it's very important today with so much stuff that comes at you, whether it's podcast, whether it's radio, whether it's television, social media, Facebook, all this stuff you're hit with. So right now, the media is obsessed with this North Korea, and they're over-dramatized this, just as we opened up there with Brian Williams, like our job tonight is to scare the hell out of you. And basically, they've been doing this with every single president. They shake the tree and they profess they're going to do all these awful things. Clinton gave them money. George Bush gave them money. Obama gave them money. Trump comes along and he goes, I ain't going to give you money. So all of a sudden now we're in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And what it can do, however, when you have this 24-hour news cycle, is it could lead to deeper oversold conditions to develop, and maybe some urgency to develop before this market weakness is finally finished. Now, as I pointed out in the first segment, the good news right now is the credit markets are telegraphing nothing serious at the moment. Credit conditions usually begin to deteriorate weeks, if not months, before there is a real risk to the financial system. This happened, if you recall, in 2011. It began with Fukushima. It began with rising oil prices, the Arab Spring, the debt ceiling debate, which eventually led to the pig crisis. But during that whole period of time, the spreads between sovereign debt like treasuries or German bonds in junk bonds, I mean, it was like a chasm. So it happened in 2011. It also happened again in the fall of 2015, right in October. Between October and the beginning of 2016, credit spreads just blew out the window, because I know we were in the market buying corporate bonds and getting some of the best deals we'd gotten in the bond market in years. But that was usually the prelude to the crisis that we saw that began the first week in the year, when literally every single week for 6 weeks consecutively, the market fell until finally the Fed had to come out and say, oh my goodness, we changed our mind. We're not going to raise. We're pulling back. But that's typically what you see, is troubles will develop in the credit markets. And right now we just don't see that.
However, Jim, from a contrarian point of view, I mean, something we've not seen until recently is this major shift that is now taking place after many years of sitting on the sidelines. The little guy's back in the stock market. People are opening record amounts of stock accounts. And as you've pointed out here on the program before, there is a new bubble forming in passive investments such as index ETFs and index mutual funds.
There's also another common complacency or investment philosophy that's become very popular right now. And as the stock market reaches new record levels, as it did this week before this downturn, the new mantra with investors is buy and hold, as well as advisors on Wall Street are preaching it. Investors should just hold on to stocks for the long term. Well, that wasn't very good advice when you saw the S&P lose 60% between 2007 and 2009. There weren't too many long-term investors buy and hold at that time. So the question you usually see in market tops is, will investors stick to this buy and hold mantra when the stock market tumbles in a bear market? And if we look, if history is any guide, the answer will probably be probably not. Because buy and hold quickly changes is get me the heck out. Not only are they quick to throw in the towel at the first sign of market turbulence, but they also tend to sit on the sidelines way too long and don't reinvest until prices are relatively high. Best example I can give you is this last bull market. It wasn't recently, until this year, and especially after the Trump election, that we really saw, as reported by major brokerage firms and also as reported by mutual funds and the fund flows into ETFs, that the individual investor is finally saying, you know, I'm back in. Because what do you hear on the news almost every single week? Well, the Dow hit another new record. The Dow hit a new record. I think it's like, what, 40, 50 new records this year? When you're hearing almost every other day that the Dow is hitting a new record, what are you thinking to yourself? You're thinking, wow, I've got to get in, because you know what? My neighbor is in and he's getting rich. So, you know, and this is something, John, that we have seen since probably going back to the day after the election of President Donald Trump, which surprised everybody, given the night before the Dow Jones Industrial Average in the futures market was down 800 points.
Right. But as buy and hold becomes popular, it would seem that market timing is popular, but usually in the opposite direction. And it always becomes a question of when you need to have somebody buy you out.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at since 2009, market timers, 98% of them have underperformed the major indexes. There was an article written in the Wall Street Journal this week, quoting two individuals, Mark Colbert being one of them. And he said he's seeing the early warning signs that market timers are hitting close to a bottom, which usually happens according to as you get towards this topping prices. James Stack, editor of Invest Tech Research, was also cited. And Stack says he's detecting market timers are as unpopular today and derided every much so as, let's say, buy and hold was back in 2009 and 2010, after the market had lost, the S&P had lost 60% of its value. It was basically, you know, buy and hold. Hey, you know, forget buy and hold. It didn't work. And quite honestly, it didn't work between 2000 and 2013 if you were fully invested and you were a long-term investor, because the stock market went nowhere. So according to Stack at Invest Tech Research, he said, excitement in the market is the greatest and the highest as the roller coaster goes over the top. And it reminds me of something I read a number of years ago at the beginning of my career. And I'm trying to think when the book was originally written. It was originally written In 1954, it was a book called The Art of Contrary Thinking by Humphrey Neal. That's N-E-I-L-L. And I highly recommend, it was very influential in getting me to view events differently. It is probably one of the best books out there and is a must reading in every investor's library. If you don't own it, it's got a new edition out. I would highly recommend that you get it. Reminds me, I have to get the new edition. But Neil talked about a couple key things. He goes, when masses of people succumb to an idea, they often run off at a tangent because of their emotions. And I mean, think back 1997 to 2000, think back real estate 2004 to 2007, or think of what's going on today with index funds. He also talked about the crowd thinks with its heart, meaning its emotions, while individuals think with their brains. And he goes on and he talks about some real key things that I think are very important for investors to grasp. And that is when you take a look at what happens, he really talks about how people ruminate and become absorbed in anything, whether it's a political, economic, or a social event. The object of contrary thinking is to challenge generally accepted viewpoints on the prevailing trends in politics and social economics. In sum, the purpose is to contest the popular view because the popular opinions are so frequently found to be untimely, misled, more by propaganda. And then he talked about what are some of the traits that make the theory of contrary opinion workable. They include people's habits, customs, imitation, contagion, fear, emotions, greed, hope, credulity, susceptibility, irritability, pride of opinion, wishful thinking, impulsiveness, and conceit. And so there are many reasons why you have to view events today, and especially the way they're presented with the multiplicity of news sources that you have at your disposal today with the internet, and to step back and make sure that you yourself don't become unwittingly part of the crowd. And basically, it's your emotions that lead your thinking.
Well, but you would think, Jim, though, I mean, if we look at it, the technicians, we have them on the show every week. Tech analysis should tell you when the primary trend changes, especially going from a bull to a bear market. If we go back to 2007-8, some of our technicians were saying exactly that. This thing's going to get ugly, and warned about this ahead of time.
Yeah, the problem here, though, another aspect of contrary thinking is when markets come to an impasse and everybody is in a quandary as to the direction prices are likely to go, then the charts, too, are usually silent. And that's usually when you'll hear technicians say, well, the market's consolidating. You'll see it. The markets trade up and down within a narrow range because there's no conclusion. The bears don't have their way. The bulls don't have their way. And it's doubtful if any technical method will ever completely enable people to overcome their inherent traits of either hope, greed, pride of opinion, and similar human failings that make successful speculation one of the most difficult arts to master. And Humphrey Neal talked about in his book, and he goes, first, as I mentioned, I learned that individual opinions, my own as well as the next man's, are of little value because so frequently they are wrong. Secondly, the human traits of fear, hope, greed, pride of opinion, wishful thinking are so strong in the human breast that they prevent one from being objective. Objective analysis of economic trends is imperative, and I believe as subjective reasoning leads to opinionated conclusions. Thirdly, he writes that if one relies stubbornly on his own opinion, he's likely to stand on his opinion, whether right or wrong. No trait is stronger, perhaps, than that of defending one's opinion and of being unwilling to admit error in judgment. Those are very, very dangerous thoughts to hold. And that's why human emotion, John, that's why there's a whole new science that is developed called behavioral finance, which does exactly that, studies human emotions. I mean, if the markets were fully efficient, as the efficient market theory and the academics would have us to believe, then how do you get internet bubbles? How did we get a financial crisis in real estate overpriced as we did in 2007? So that's why it is very difficult to separate yourself from the crowd and more typical to jump to the conclusions that the public opinion is as you wish it were. In other words, you are now starting to agree with that opinion. Then unconsciously, you become a member of the public, and in reality, you think exactly is the crowd. At that point, you become a member of the crowd.
You know, and Jim, it's very, very easy to do that today. That's what we started out talking about in this segment of the show, because there is so much thrown at us. As a matter of fact, most of it's what I call data points rather than a perspective. And you can let the data points flood over you and cause you to make some pretty bad decisions.
Yeah, and it's amazing because Neil relied on a Frenchman, Gustave Le Bon, who wrote a book called Psychology of Crowds. And Le Bon talked about a couple things. He said the basic distinction, of course, between a crowd and an individual is this. Whereas an individual may act after reasoning and analysis, a crowd acts on feelings and emotion. Crowds also follow leaders. Can you remember, John, the gurus that they used to have on CNBC in the financial channels in 1998? It would be like one person, a guru. Warren Buffett would be an example. Warren Buffett comes out and says something about a stock or a company and the market reacts. So they follow the actions of leaders, and the crowd is very susceptible to what Le Bon calls contagion, because a crowd does not think. It acts on impulses. Public opinions, as we have seen so often, are wrong. And by the same token, because a crowd is carried away by feelings or sentiment, you will find the public participating enthusiastically in various manias after mania as they gather steam and momentum. The crowd is attracted by the activity, and there's nothing that gets the attention of the crowd than the movement of prices, especially rising prices. And this is why you see these things happen so often, so many times, and why we keep repeating the question. And also, John, in this way, public officials act in the same way, and that's this reliance on the wisdom of public officials. Like, we pay a lot of attention to the Fed. Well, Fed chairman said this, or Fed chairman said that. What you really have to do is watch when the Fed does act in what their actions are actually doing, and then look for a follow-through to events in the economy as a result of what they're doing rather than what they're saying.
So this is where, I guess, the old adage, don't run with the herd, because the herd's usually running in the wrong direction. This is where the art of contrary thinking comes in. And it's going to be helpful when it turns, because everybody at that stage, if you're right about, and I think you are, about the three stages of what every bull market has been in the past, is when the euphoria kicks in the third stage, and everybody's jumping in saying the sky is the limit, that's when you need to be really cautious. And so being a contrarian is going to help when this market turns.
Yeah. And, you know, if we just take a look at what are the things that we know, they're pretty clear right now. Number one, the Fed is in a rate raising cycle. Number two, we are in the late stages of a business cycle. The longest lasting cycle has been 10 years. We're in year 9. What do we also know? We know that bond spreads are the lowest that they've been. Number four, we know that stock prices are overpriced. Number five, the public is back in. Number six, a bubble is forming in index funds. And number seven, as we talked about last week, for the moment, the LEIs are heading up. Profits are at record levels. We are not close to a recession, so things are still positive. In summary, it's still safe to keep on dancing. But as Ray Dalio and as others have said on this program, just make sure you got an eye on the exit door.
So, Jim, as we look forward to the rest of the year, what will the market be doing? We've still got some time left. What will we be watching for?
Well, the month of August tends to be very slow, although we do have some geopolitical news, which the media is running haywire with North Korea. We've got Jackson Hole coming up in the month. We have the conclave of Fed officials meeting in Jackson Hole, so they'll be anxious to see what Janet Yellen has to say on that, what they're going to go ahead with their shrinkage of the Fed's balance sheet. And of course, during August, when the traders are in the Hamptons, it doesn't take much to move the markets in any direction, as Art Hill talked about in hour one. But then as we come back in September, we'll be looking at Q3 earnings and also the LEIs, and also heading into the fall and what happens if we follow the typical pattern Third quarter should have strong economic growth. That's being supported by the LAIs that we're seeing now. As we said last week, things are looking good, so you can still keep dancing. And the other thing is, we'll see if we get that strong reflationary rally that we typically get in the fourth quarter of the year. So those are the things we'll be looking at as we head into our August recess. We have some really great interviews, and one I'm really proud that we were able to get. It is an author of one of the best books ever written about the bond market, and they'll be coming up during our August recess, as well as a documentary filmmaker. Some great surprises coming your way at the end of August. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.